All right, we're back on the record, and at this time, Commissioner Kulk, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. All right. Thanks for your testimony, Mr. Diller. Let's get to it, huh? Okay. I'm sure my colleagues will have a lot of good questions, too, so I won't monopolize all the time. A couple cleanup questions. Where are we at with the return check fee? $20, $40, $15? Where did that settle out?
I think it's currently at $15, if I remember. It's in my testimony. And as part of the settlement agreement, that will not change.
Why? Why shouldn't they get more money than $15? How many bucks?
Well, because I complained about it, I guess.
Is it a large amount of money we're talking, I wonder?
Well, think about it. The average bill in 2014, if I remember the annual report, is for residential customers like $65 in 2014. If MDU charges them $40 and their bank charges them $30 or $40, the people who can least afford to pay for gas is, you know, they're looking at $80 worth of charges.
So your point was that the coupling of fees from what the bank charges them?
Well, I'm just looking at it from a holistic view, I guess, and putting myself in a customer's shoes that's a little low on cash. And it doesn't help that the banks and then MDU comes along and charges them $40, $30, whatever the banks charge.
Do you recall what we have set up? Because this, ironically, I've never thought of this in our rate cases. Other companies?
Yeah.
We've never dealt with this before.
I suspect that NSP's is probably $40. I had the same thought when I ran across this. Commissioner, I've not always done rate design myself, and so I'm sure.
Are you against if it ends up being $30, Mike?
Am I against it?
Yep.
Commissioners, you guys rule. Whatever you decide.
No, but am I missing some fatal flaw other than the pancaking of fees?
That's why I argued against
okay.
it.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to flush out that line of discussion with you, Mike. I should open with this comment. In previous rate cases, you've shown some concern with MDU's openness about getting you the data. I'm sensing that wasn't the case this time.
I think that staff and the company are working better together than they have in the past, and I think that's from efforts on both sides.
Okay, so there was no – it seems to me that – I mean, you're very candid. In the previous rate case, you gave us your thoughts very candidly. But this time, everything you asked for, you got. There was really not a lot of questions back and forth that you didn't get resolved.
Anytime that you're exchanging that that amount of information back and forth, there's going to be situations where you go, why did they provide that? I wanted that, you know, and it can be just a communication issue. And I would say it's always a communication issue, but I feel like, Commissioner, that MDU is working harder to provide better information. I didn't say it up front, but I'm thankful for that. It makes our job easier.
Sure. Okay. And then let's see here. I kind of got a shotgun effect here to my questions, but there's one thing that on the rate design that you talked about small interruptibles, and if you break it down into some of their different classes,
right.
The one class for grain dryers, and not grain dryers, for vehicles gets really hammered pretty hard. Well, give me some more information about that.
Yeah.
Do you recall what I'm...
I do.
I can't find it now, of course.
Yeah, just give me a second here. Rather than... let's just use my MRD3 in my testimony. If you go all the way to the last page, there's a long schedule there. And I think that's what you're talking about. The small interruptible class represented on PSC4.
Yep.
It combines small interruptible sales. Oh.
Yeah, 29% increase to small interruptible transportation rate.
Right.
So yeah. What is that? Just what it says?
Well, one is transportation. If you go flip all the way back to the very last page.
Okay.
And then so we don't even have to get lost in the paragraphs of language.
All right. Go ahead, Mike. Okay. I don't think I have the same document.
And so Oh, you don't have it. All right. Well,
just walk me through what it is.
Yeah, the small interruptible sales is both. It's both delivery and sales. Small interruptible transportation customers. It's just the delivery of gas. they arrange for their own gas.
So are we?
We're just transporting gas to them from their provider.
Okay. Are we setting the stage here, though, for a mass exodus of people to fuel switch that are now small interruptible? You said you don't think so, and the company doesn't think so, but we're trying to get more uses for gas, not encourage people to go somewhere else.
Right. That's where I say in my written testimony, and I've already said today, that I have to trust that MDU knows their business. I'm not in their shoes. I'm not doing their business every day. I can't do a back. Maybe I could do a back of the envelope calculation for propane. I've not done that, I'm trusting that MDU knows their business and they know how far they can move those rates up and still retain all customers. They've told me that they can indeed do that, and so I'm trusting them. To John Kaufman's question, I think he was getting at, well, maybe we could increase it more yet. 6.78% increase in one time is pretty. It's a lot. So, but I'm fully trusting in MDU to know their business in that regard.
The small interruptibles, they seem like they pay they pay a good chunk of the bills for MDU over the course of a year, correct? The total, 200 different companies, or not companies, 200 different.
Well, the small interruptible, again, the small interruptible sales revenues, around $5 million. The small interruptible transportation revenues, around $700,000.
Okay.
Dollars.
All righty. So now I'll talk about the other side of my mouth here a little bit. So I was just talking about how we might not want to hit one group so much. But the point of PSC4 was that you're trying to show everybody should be paying one of the points. A point is everybody should pay their fair share.
Right.
And if I'm looking at point PSC4, the residentials still aren't paying their fair share, and the small interruptibles still aren't paying their fair share.
That's how I would read this.
So yes. Any arguments to the other thing is that even by doing this, we're still going to have some groups be subsidized by other groups.
Based on the class cost of service study that staff is recommending here, the 100% allocation of gas mains on a demand basis, yes.
Knowing what you know about MDU and the way that rate design and what's best in parentheses, if we were to assign an increased cost to a group, firm general, large interruptible, or not have the Air Force actually be decreased, where do you think would be the class group that could take an increase the best?
I believe that I'm trusting MDU to have established interruptible rates that are competitive, but not so competitive that they're leaving margins on the table, so to speak. Air Force is very high. So to get to your question, really you have a choice between residential and firm general. In my mind, that's your choice. And so,
all righty. Why in the past did the commissions, and I was part of the rate cases before that did this, so, but why do you think we got here? How do we get down this road so far? And I agree, and I understand your points about Excel, that we've pulled it back in other IOUs, and I think that's where I'm at right now philosophically. But how do we get down to this point?
Did I swear to tell the truth? Or
yes, you
did.
You did.
I did.
I didn't, but you did. But I will.
Well, I think sometimes when we have elected officials and the voting class is represented in the residential block, that that could be part of it. It could be that, you know, not that AARP has been always invested in our proceedings, but if you have a group like AARP and arguing for the residential customer, that could also possibly keep residential classes lower than they otherwise would because you have another intervener that's just representing residential customers.
Could it have been there was incentives for these larger users that paid less for gas rates the more volume they used, that that's why they were incentivized that way, so they paid? So, I mean, that, sometimes yeah, I look at it, that's that, why that's, it may have happened.
Yeah, that's. I think that's an interesting observation. So in times when, let's say, alternative heating sources are more competitive, that would push down what you could charge for interruptible rates. And if that's the case, then you've got to push up residential class and firm class to cover that. So,
do you know in the large industrial rates, even the firm general, that there's incentives that, not incentives, but there's different price points the more you use? Is that still built into all these rates?
Let's see. Got to think. I have a handy little dandy cheat of rates. Let me look here.
It's more a curiosity than anything. I'm just curious if there's still have that big built-in for some of the large groups.
Could you say that again? Ask the question.
In previous cases, and maybe it was just electricity, maybe it wasn't gas, where after a certain amount, the cost even decreased further, so it actually incentivizes using more.
Oh, okay. I don't believe that we have that in effect in any of the rates.
Because gas, they have to pay for the cost, no matter whether it's the first one
you
or
pay
the last one.
Yeah.
So there's no incentive then that exists to use more. Okay. And I think, let me double check my notes here, Mike. Oh, you did talk about NSP, and there's that 18 something a month. I remember that before. Am I missing anybody else that we regulate for gas? That's it.
Great Plains Natural Gas Company, MDU, owns Great Plains now.
Oh, I know what it was, Mike. The last question, if the rates stay as lays out right now in the settlement agreement, are they paying this residential customer paying more or less than what the interim rate is?
Slightly less.
So, say that again.
less. I said slightly less.
The interim rate is less than what the final rate will be? Or the other way around?
The interim rate is slightly more.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry.
So, even if we stay with where we're at, what the customer's been paying will be more than what the final bill will pay. We're confusing ourselves.
The
interim rates are higher than the final rates in the settlement agreement.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Let's see. Okay, I just want to start with something that has been on my mind since I first looked at this case, even the last time we talked about this. And I just want an explanation from you about why it's called a straight fixed variable. Fixed and variable. Why is it called that? That seems contradictory to me.
Yeah. Why the straight?
Why the fixed variable? I mean, I can get rid of the straight, but it's fixed variable rate. And
you know, I've never thought about it. I've never, but to me, straight fixed variable, it's just a fixed and variable rate, not multiple variable rates. It's just.
How does it vary? It seems like it's just fixed. It doesn't vary.
Oh, well, I think they're assuming there's cost of gas that varies. So that's what I'm thinking, straight fixed variable. So you have a straight fixed rate.
Plus the variable.
Plus
I
the
see.
Cost of gas.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I guess I've never thought about that.
So that applies to not just this portion of the rate, but the whole rate as a whole. The rate as a whole. It's a fixed variable rate.
That's what I would assume.
The variable.
That's what
all right.
I would assume.
Good. also, explain to me how the weather normalization adjustment works and how that impacts customers.
Okay.
Sorry.
You know, I think maybe I will use a response that I filed in regard to ARP's interrogatories to answer your question. And see how I can adapt it here. The degree day per customer times the coldest degree day in the last 30 years indicates the level of gas needed per customer.
The degree day per customer.
I'm sorry, this is peak day design.
Okay.
Okay, so you adjust volumes based on weather, and the weather difference is determined on something called heating degree days, and it basically indexes current a current month, a current day, a current year, index it to a normal period, say 30 years. The heating degree day that I'm familiar with, and maybe there's different ones, but the heating degree day is determined by taking the lowest temperature and the highest temperature of that day divided by two, and that gives you and that number, let's see, less 60. It's the index is set on 60 degrees, and so the assumption is that people don't really start heating their homes till the temperature goes below 60 degrees. And so let me give you an example for heating degree days. So let's say it's the coldest part of the day is zero, and it warms up to 20 degrees. Mm-hmm. Zero and 20 divided by two, so the average heating degree day is 10. But the heating degree, it's not that complicated. I'm just having a bad time. So the difference between 60 and 10 is 50, and that's the heating degree day for that day.
Okay.
So then you can start normalizing. Let's just use one day, okay? We're just going to normalize one day. Normally, the heating degree day is 40, but this day it's 50. So there's 10 heating degree days difference, and so then you can do you can do regression analysis to determine how much extra heat you need for the difference in that temperature difference. Mm-hmm. On a normalized basis, so
the company does this calculation. Tell me how the companies use this.
So if you have a warmer than normal February, that means they sold less gas, mm-hmm. and so the DDSM would be calculated to recover lost margins due to that difference in weather.
And then, so they do this every month all winter long?
November through May.
Okay. So they normalize, and some days it's probably colder than normal, and some days it's warmer. So they basically add this extra charge onto customers' bills in the winter?
Or subtract.
Or during those months?
Or subtract. Okay. Yes, there's a line item on there, DDSM charges. And so occasionally I do get a phone call, what is that?
Mm-hmm.
And
did you explain it like this? I hope not.
Hopefully I would do better. But no, we talk about it on a very general level. And one of the things that bothers customers sometimes. They say, well, you used less gas last month, so we got to charge you more now.
Right.
And that generates some more conversation, of course. But that's how it works. If you have a warmer than normal month, the customer is billed surcharged, charged extra because the company didn't sell the normal amount of gas that we planned for, or they planned for, that revenue requirements are set on. So,
So they're kind of, through this, they're sort of guaranteed a certain amount of revenue? Is that what you're saying?
Street fixed variable? Or?
No. Oh, under this, with weather normalization, they're guaranteed a certain amount of revenue. And if they don't, if the weather is
is
not cold enough and they don't sell enough, they make it up somehow through this.
It's exactly right. It trues up differences in weather. It trues up sales due to differences in weather.
Do customers have any control over this?
They don't have any control over weather, and the DDSM is just a mathematical, statistical calculation that's more or less automatic. So,
and is this all classes pay this, or just residential, or have the weather normalization factor?
It would be applied to the firm customers. I don't think it's applied to the interruptible customers, but. I guess you'd have to ask Tammy for.
All right.
Sorry. Okay.
And she is it decided? Who decides how much they get to make basically every month? Who decides what this weather normalization charge is going to be? Like the total amount of revenues they can get in November through May and recoup through this weather normalization. Who sets that? Is that part of the tariff? A tariff someplace?
Yes, it's part of the tariff. I don't know what subscription or who they subscribe to get heating degree day information that drives the calculation. I don't know if they use NOAA or who. I don't know that. But, it's a mathematical calculation.
And this is something approved by us
in the tariffs
through the rate cases. Yep. And this fixed variable eliminates that charge, the weather normalization.
It eliminates DDSM. It doesn't really change the fact that under DDSM, their firm service customers are weather normalized. Under straight fixed variable for residential, they're still weather normalized. Doesn't change depending on weather. And so the DDSM will continue for the other customer classes.
Okay, but it comes off. Residential customers will no longer see that.
Yep.
Did you do any calculations as to the impact that would have on customers? Or
I didn't.
Okay. All right, thank you. That's helpful to better understand that. On the customer class cost of service study, you had a pretty extensive conversation with AARP about that and the different allocation factors and how they, like the one that is being changed in this on the how the distribution mains are allocated to 100% demand. Rather than 75 demand, 25 customer. Can you is that one of the largest or most significant allocation factors in terms of impact to customers? I mean, you said it's a $1.5 million reduction in residential revenue requirements.
That's typically why witnesses on class cost of service study mess around with the allocation of distribution mains, because it is the most significant cost, I think, probably outside of cost of gas. I may be overstating it, but and so if you identify, one of the largest areas and you adjust the class for different scenarios, you get a range of impacts to the various classes.
Okay. Are there other allocation factors that could have a significant impact on residential customers?
Well, not like the distribution mains, but I think in my testimony, I state that if the commission wants to get more involved in class cost of service studies, then you should think about hiring somebody to develop their own class cost of service study in the next rate case. But again, my testimony also suggests that the class cost of service study is a guide. It's a range for the commission's consideration. I know my testimony looked kind of wishy-washy compared to some of the hard-charging testimony that I sometimes provide. But that's just recognizing that rate design's a different animal altogether than revenue requirements, where this number plus that one equals that. There's a lot of policy. There's a lot of variability, a lot of different options, all the allocation factors, 40 of them I think we heard from about yesterday. Could you go in there and adjust those and make some changes? I'm sure that I could.
Mm-hmm. But you feel that this is the biggest one, most significant impact
yes,
to residential customers?
I believe it is, yes.
Now, this might be a leap, so that's why I'm asking you if I'm thinking this through accurately. But distribution mains are developed and sized, and now they're being charged on demand. So the volumetric, this is a it's a volumetric adjustment that we're now taking off of the residentials and putting it on other customers more, correct? So are we not, with that move, somehow also decreasing the, or recognizing that residential customers shouldn't be paying for big, huge mains that they aren't using?
Well, the class cost of service study uses, it's called a peak day design, but it's a demand allocation factor to allocate those a portion of those mains to each class. And in the case of residential, it's something like 47% of mains. I'd have to look to
I think that's right.
Okay, 47%. And so that share of mains is being allocated down to the residential class.
Then how does the moving of the demand, the moving of the allocation factor from 75-25 to 100% demand reduce the revenue so much from residentials?
How does it?
Yeah. I mean.
Well, because the.
Seems like that number should also go down then.
Because of.
The 47%. Wouldn't that decrease?
No, that allocation factor wouldn't change. But the reason it goes down is MDU's method is to allocate 75% of those distribution mains on demand and 25% of those mains on customer numbers. The residential class has 86% of the customers. And so under their method, they're allocating more costs to to the residential class just by fact that the residential class has a lot more customers. And so when I take the custom that 25% out based on customers and put it all towards demand, and we know that 47% of those costs of demand costs are going to the
okay.
You got it?
Yep,
okay.
I got it. Thank you. let's see. That illustration you mentioned of MDU's residential customer gas use, I would like to see that. If I'm thinking of what you described, would be a graph that shows all the customers, their use. Some would be down here with 50, maybe 20 decatherms, and all the way up. And so you'd see the concentration in the range and how many are on the fringes.
So the chart you'd like MDU to present would be you'd have percentages up this side, and then you'd have decatherms use on the x-axis, and so you'd have maybe 10, 20, 30, all the way out to, you know, however far, 300.
Whatever the most is. For
yeah, whatever the most is. And then you would see the percentages under each of those usages. You'd see that most of them end up between 50 and 150 decatherms. At least that's what I would expect. But if you requested that, I don't know why MDU wouldn't provide it to you.
Well, and that would get to help us to evaluate if your bullet point on the relatively uniform class usage is...
Yes, it would.
...is true. Okay. So can we request that from the company and have that as a late-filed exhibit?
We can do that.
Okay. Thank you.
That will be
MDU 17.
17.
Okay. A couple questions then on the settlement. In the settlement agreement, I was reading the AARP's portion of what they support and don't support, and they said they don't object to the terms in the settlement agreement related to revenue requirement issues. Does that mean they don't? Did they in the negotiations, and they aren't testifying, so I can't ask them this myself, object to the company's need for more revenues? I haven't heard that in any questions or anything else, that they object to the basic premise that MDU has a lot of investments that they're making and they need more revenues from customers.
Vic sponsored, AARP has agreed to the rate of return requirements that are in the settlement agreement, agreed to by all parties. What they've not agreed to is rate design.
But did you, are you able to say where they objected to the revenue increases, expressed concerns about the need for more revenue?
I don't recall having that conversation. As I recall in the negotiation discussions, I think Mr. Kaufman was the only one present by phone, and he was pretty quiet during the negotiation process.
Okay, so then I want to, so it really comes down to the rate design issue, which they spell out in their letter too, saying what they disagree with. In the letter that we received from a number of AARP members and customers, MDU customers, there was really three issues that the customers pointed out in all these letters. And it was the going to the fixed variable rate, applying the way the rates are applied to the various customer classes, and the rate stabilization mechanism. So the rate stabilization mechanism is gone in the settlement. In terms of the, so I want to ask you a couple questions about some of the concerns we're hearing from the customers, and that is, let's see here. Expresses. That this method, the proposal does not increase rates for everyone. It exempts large commercial users and corporations at the expense of hardworking North Dakotans like this gentleman. Is that true in how this rate, the rates are established, and why or why not? Does it exempt large commercial users and corporations? Are they included in some of the classes that are seeing an increase, small interruptible,
well,
for example?
Well, I still have PSC 4 in front of me, and that basically shows which classes are getting, what increases. In column 2 there, the firm general is not getting a rate increase. The large interruptible is not getting a rate increase. If you're a corporation and you're receiving small interruptible service, you're getting a large increase. And so,
who's in the small interruptible? What types of customers are in that?
I just look at the numbers. I don't have customer names when I'm doing my analysis, so I'm not sure.
Okay. Yeah. If you increase the costs on the large interruptibles, you had a long conversation with Mr. Kaufman about that, and he seemed to indicate that he thought there was more room for increasing those rates based on the description of who those customers are. I'd say they are large corporations. What's the risk of driving them away? And what kind of impact does that have on residential customers if you lose some of those big users?
Well, are you talking just large interruptible now?
Sure.
Trying to think where I can put my hands on the amount of. I don't know off the top of my head what kind of margins, what kind of profit margins that class is providing, but I could look at.
Do you know how much revenue they generate?
Yeah. Let me get back. Let's see if this. I'll just look at their class cost of service. This is MDU's class cost of service study. The large interruptible class. Whoops, that's rate base. Okay, all right. Sorry for fumbling around here. Total. So large interruptible customers have a total projected operating income of $436,000.
So that's their sales? Total sales?
I'm trying to. Operating income. Oh, that would be net operating income, $436,000. Let's see. Yep.
So if you lose that, if they say we've got other options.
So if you lost all of that, you'd have to go to another class.
Okay. Yep. And the small interruptibles are receiving a significant rate increase, and they generate $5.7 million in sales, somebody said earlier. So the one class that's being left out in the proposed distribution of rate increase is the firm general. I'm assuming that's a pretty substantial contributor of revenue.
Okay, revenue. I was giving you net income, but for let's see, for small firm. Projected net income, small firm's about $1 million, large firm is $1.7 million.
So really the small interruptible is one of the larger generators of and they are seeing a rate increase.
Small interruptible, what did I say?
$1 million? See, I've got $5.7 million in sales is something I wrote down from.
I'm just looking at margins, net income.
Yeah. So the question is, are these commercial users and corporations can you, is it accurate to say that that what you're proposing is leaving them out?
Leaving them out of a rate increase?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if you want to break it down to that level, if there's no rate increase granted, large interruptible or firm general, and you're a corporation that falls in that class, there would be no increase in rates, so they're left out of the rate increase. But that's, you know, that's the value of PSC4 here is. And it's not only the returns being provided, large interruptible being 10.6%, it's also the idea of market-based rates. We want to have interruptible rates that are competitive. We can't afford to leave them. Otherwise, we'll be looking at increasing residential and firm customers' rates.
Okay. And are some of the those... Could some of those types of customers fall in small interruptible that are getting a rate increase?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
All right. In your experience working with an advocate for customers, what's important to them? Their total bill or how the bill is broken down and what they pay under the various lines in the bill?
Well, I'm an advocate for all classes, all customers, mm-hmm. and I probably don't have as much experience with large customers calling in and asking questions. Almost, I'm trying to think if I've ever had a large customer call in. It's generally residential. I guess it would depend on who you are, Commissioner. I just look at the bottom number, and if that looks like what I'm expecting, then that's as far as I look. Whether other customers do that or not, I don't know.
In your experience working through this fixed variable with NSP, what did, you know, customers, did they notice the overall impact, or were they focused on where it was coming
from?
Well,
that's a good point. The fact that we received 10 or 15 calls after we implemented that for the first time would suggest that maybe a lot of the residential customers are, in fact, like Mike Diller, and look at the bottom line and go, yeah, that's about right. Of the 10 or 15 that called in, they clearly looked at their bill, and they saw the basic service charge go from $5 to $15, and they wanted to know what the heck was going on, and picked up the phone, and we had conversation.
Okay. Could you go through the calculation again on the point, on the 3 cents per decatherm, and how that impacts a, say, 100 decatherm average use customer?
Sure. So MDU's class cost of service study, again, allocates costs in customer charges, energy charges, and demand charges. And the energy charges that class cost of service study comes up with outside the cost of gas is 3 cents a decatherm. And so I've been using 100 decatherms as average, but and let's use it because that makes it easy. So if the average customer uses 100 decatherms a year, 100 times 3 cents is $3. And you divide that by 12, you know, it starts to get a really small number. And so hence I'm arguing that let's not have another energy charge for 3 cents a decatherm. I don't want to get any more of those calls where they call me in and they say, how come I'm paying 2 gas charges? And I'm, what do you mean 2 gas charges? Mm-hmm. Well, the cost of gas, and then there's this thing called DDC, distribution delivery charge. Why am I paying for gas twice? And then you get into some really interesting conversations trying to explain what a distribution delivery charge is, but
okay.
All for 3 cents a decatherm. I don't think we need that.
Mm-hmm. So the you laid out all the 14 different benefits or values for the fixed variable rate. What are the advantages of the current formula? Just be devil's advocate and try to find some for me value of the current, the way of doing it now with the distribution delivery charge.
Well, I think from Mr. Kaufman and my discussion, we got really right down the brass tacks. There is a demand cost associated with serving residential customers. We don't have demand meters. We don't know which house is using more demand than one or less, other than based on usage, which may occur during the peak demand time or may not. So you have to weigh all the benefits that I put in there, up there on the second slide, versus a contrived, so to speak, distribution delivery charge that represents demand costs. And is that more accurate or not? It's hard to say. It's based on how people use heat in their house.
Does it come back to the uniform class usage, identifying how uniform the class usage is?
And it does. It comes back to that. Do we want the extra complexity in a bill for a small amount of money difference between one customer and the next? Do we want it? Really, it boils down to that, Commissioner. Do we want that extra complexity when a fixed cost, a straight fixed variable rate will work just fine, and we have good experience with it? And
okay, then I just have two other quick questions. On the Air Force and the settlement agreement, you went beyond what the company had proposed, which was hold even for the Air Force, and you recommended a decrease in their rate. Yesterday, the Air Force said that they would accept hold even. How do you feel about holding even on the Air Force versus a decrease?
Again, the commissioner's rule. I made the recommendation because I saw a situation which would never rectify itself. And there's something that I haven't said to this point, and I'll offer it here, is, a good time to make structural changes in rates is when the cost of gas is low. And we're in a situation like that, and so it's to me, $40,000 doesn't change anything. Changes $40,000. It's so small compared to the total amount. Where you put that, if you wanted to move that $40,000 somewhere else, offset residential increase, you're talking about a $2.3 million right now increase in residential. To reduce that by $40,000 isn't gonna amount
okay.
amount to anything, but or much. It's not going to amount to much.
I'm asking because I noticed in the settlement agreement that if there's any modifications to the settlement, parties would have 3 business days of objecting, and so I wanted to get your sense on that.
I don't have anything else to say.
Okay. that's all my questions for now. Thanks, Mike.
Commissioner Christman?
Well, Your Honor, most of my questions have been asked and answered, so, but just a few, and I'll kind of take up where you left off with the federal it's referred to in here as the Minot Air Force Base, but we kind of got into that yesterday. It's federal agencies. You've been here for, what, 20-some years?
28 and on October 11th, 2015.
So do you... has this been pretty close to how their situation has been the whole time, or has their rate of return been growing during that 28 years, and now this would contract it, or
talking residential or
no what? the Air Force.
Oh, Air Force. I think it was even worse last time. I can't be certain. It's been a while since I've looked at the last class cost of service study that was filed in the last rate case. Is that what?
Well, in the last rate case, it was already significantly high. I guess what I'm wondering is 20, 25, 30 years ago, did they already pay a way higher or already account for a way higher rate of return than the other classes and it's just remained consistent? Or has it been in the last, you know, 5 or 10 or 15 years that has shot up?
I don't recall that far back, but as I do have Jerry Lean's testimony from the last time, and so I think maybe I can tell you what it was in the last rate case. I think I have it somewhere in this pile. Well, according to Jerry's test, go ahead.
That's probably not so important anyway. I was mainly looking for a longer term history of.
I just don't.
20 or 30. Okay. How did we reach this figure? Mr. Collins, I believe yesterday said that he would have, you know, liked to reduce it by like $85,000, I think he said, which was the whole amount that they're off. But he originally proposed about half of that, which was the 43. And then somehow or another, that got nicked by just a little bit down to 39.8. And that seems like such a small difference from 43, but yet it took some action to do that. How did that change?
Oh, boy, you're not going to like this answer. I knew the number was somewhere around $80,000, so in the negotiation process, I just threw out a number of $40,000. How it got to 39,887 or whatever the number is, I don't know how we got to. I suggested $40,000. I think the settlement agreement is slightly different than that. 39,767,000.
So there was no big issue or difference. It just kind of the rounding or something and how it worked out.
I knew that it was approximately $80,000 of excess earnings, and so I just said let's get halfway there.
Okay.
And threw out the number $40,000, and MDU accepted that. So.
If we were to choose not to do that and instead used that roughly $40,000 of lowering to offset the increase in residential, I'm thinking through what the impact would be. So am I correct that as currently proposed in the settlement, the average residential increase is about $350 a month, right?
$2, I think, is $2.04 is what I
recall. $204.
Yep.
And so if we applied this $40,000 towards that, it's going to be a very small difference, like $2 or something then, right?
I guess you could take $40,000. Does anybody have a, can I use that? $40,000 divided by about 2.3 million So 1.7% difference. So I could take that times the 3.34. So it maybe change it from 3.34 to 3.28.
Percent,
yes. Yes, I'm dealing in percents here, sorry. So the 3.34% would be 2.28%, if I did my math right.
But the $2.04 would become like $2 or something close to that, correct?
All right. It'd be very small, but let's see. So what did I say? 40. How do I clear? Okay. Difference, so minus one. I can't figure out how to clear this thing. I'm getting the memory, some memory issues here.
You know, and I don't need an exact amount. My point is it's going to be a few pennies, right?
It's not going to be.
It's not going to be a quarter even or anything like that.
No.
Right? I just wanted to have that clear on the record that
maybe 12 cents if I remember the other numbers that I had in there at one point, maybe 12 cents difference. That sounds like too much, but maybe.
Okay, we'll just move on from there. Lastly, you referenced that NSP case when you changed their billing to the straight delivery charge. Over what period of time did you get the complaints? Was it all, you know, just about in the first couple months of heating season?
No, it was pretty much right after it was implemented. I don't know if I can tell quickly when. Well, let's see. Let's see if I have the. So the order adopting the initial settlement was issued June 1 of 05. So if they got that implemented in, you know, a couple of months, August. I can't recall. It seems like it was fairly soon right after the order was reached.
Do you think in hindsight there might have been usefulness in including that billing on their bill and then having a like credit pointing out that that was eliminated by that rate case so that when they first... the first times that they got that bill and it showed a higher monthly service charge, there also would have been something on there in the same box that showed that the distribution charge was eliminated?
Yeah. Well, that's a good idea, and I don't recall doing that with NSP. I know that we had bill inserts that were included in bills to explain what was going on, but that's an idea that I didn't think of at the time. No.
Okay. All my other questions were already answered. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Hsu.
Your Honor. Mr. Diller, in regards to firm general service, could it be possible that not only corporations but also small proprietors fall into firm general class?
Absolutely.
In regards to the class cost of service study, You reviewed many cost of service studies, correct?
Many?
Yes, over the years.
I didn't do that when I was with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, and we only have three companies that we regulate here in North Dakota, but I've looked at class cost of service studies in the past for NSP, MDU, Otter Tail.
Okay, and you reviewed this one today on this current case?
Yes.
Right, and you found it to be reasonable?
Well, I think my method is better than MDU's method.
Right, and
but
so,
I think overall it's good, and it provides a good range for the commission to consider.
Right, so overall, with your adjustments, you find that would be a good approach as well. But either way, it would be a reasonable approach.
I prefer my method.
Have you felt the need to hire out? Have you found that it was so unreasonable? If you found it unreasonable to the point that it was unfixable, would you have hired out a consultant or redone the class cost of service study yourself, correct?
Well, that would have been an option, but like I said several times already in this proceeding, this is a class cost of service study that has been used in the past. It's one I'm familiar with, and it's there to provide a guide. My testimony also says if the commission wants to become if the commission wants to rely on the class cost of service study to a greater degree, then perhaps it should hire someone to look at it harder than this staff is capable of looking at it.
Okay. I have no other questions, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Koontz?
I have a few questions, Your Honor. Mr. Diller, I believe you testified that in rate design, you can't necessarily be a slave to the outcome of the cost of service study. You have to give it practical considerations. Is that correct?
That's a good summary.
And am I correct then that that's consistent with your proposal that it doesn't make sense to have a 3-cent charge, even though your cost of service study might reflect that there's a volumetric piece of the company's cost of serving residential service equal to 3 cents per decatherm.
Right.
You mentioned the fact that the company's class cost of service study allocated mains 25% to customers, 75% demand. You preferred 100% demand, right?
That's right.
Are you familiar with the arguments of why a percentage of the main should be allocated on a customer basis?
Yes.
Can you describe for the commission what the argument would be for the company's allocation method, even though you disagree with it?
Yeah. Well, mains are used to serve customers, right? And so what percentage should be used to reflect that? I think that I've seen in previous MDU gas cases that it hasn't always been 25%, that I think MDU used 30-some percent in earlier rate cases. So does that answer your question?
But there's a minimum size main that you have to put in just to serve the neighborhood, correct?
Right, yeah.
So if everybody, all they did was run their pilot lights all year long just to and have the availability of service in the unlikely event they would need it, you would still have to put a piece of pipe in the ground to serve that neighborhood, would you not?
Yes.
And there would be a cost associated with getting that main in the ground, even at that minimal size. If it's a half-inch or an inch-size main, there's a cost associated with digging that main in the ground and the cost of that particular pipe, correct?
Sure.
And so then if you look at it like the person that you visited with and, you know, looking at, well, my average usage for this many customers suggests I need a 4-inch main instead of a 1/2-inch main, that's based upon their demand for that group of customers, correct?
Right.
So if you really, the argument would be that it's only the incremental cost between the minimum size main and the size main based upon the demand of that customer group that would be allocated on demand, and the rest would be based on customers. Isn't that kind of the argument?
I think it is, yes.
And so reasonable people can disagree on these cost of allocation studies as to how you allocate some of those costs.
Sure, you could also say that mains are built throughput. And so, you know, there's a million different ways you could do a class cost of service study.
And that brings me to another point I wanted to bring out, that even though we've been kind of focused on the fixed piece of the distribution charge portion of the customer's bill here, there is still a significant portion of the company's rate design that's usage-based, is it not? The cost of the commodity.
Right, 71% of it.
It's just that that particular piece is strictly a pass-through, but still part of the company's rate design.
Yes.
And that's totally usage-based.
That's right.
And I think you probably answered this in response to a question by Mr. Hsu, but I want to make sure. The question is, are small, are businesses and corporations left out of the rate increase? The small interruptible customer, those are business customers, aren't they?
I would assume that they are, yes.
You're not aware of residential customers being on interruptible service?
I'm not.
So to the extent that customer group is consists of businesses, whether they be corporations or small or proprietorships, they're not left out of the rate increase.
No.
If you were to do a cost of service study within the residential customer class and on a volumetric basis, isn't it true, Mr. Diller, that the larger users within that group would actually see their rates decline on a per decatherm basis in comparison to a customer that used some minimal amount of volume?
Yes.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman?
Yes, a couple. Well, first of all, just on the large commercial customer question, that, well, it may be true that some large commercial customers would be paying a rate increase on the settlement. There are some large corporations or large commercial customers that wouldn't be paying any rate increase as a result of the settlement.
That's right.
And based on the questions about the straight fixed variable rate design, which I'd also like to call straight fixed rate design, do you follow other utility commissions and cases where this issue has been litigated and contested in other states?
I don't. As far as I know, we were the pioneers back in 2005, and the rest of the countries followed us. So I don't follow what other states.
The idea has been around a while, but have you seen the result of rate cases where this issue was contested in other states such as Missouri, Kentucky, Minnesota, Kansas this year?
You know, I know there's different kinds of people in the world. I'm one of those that I don't pay attention a lot to what other states are doing.
So you wouldn't know whether those commissions had rejected increases in the customer charge based on policy reasons.
My understanding is some states have moved to a straight fixed variable rate, and others probably haven't. But I don't have any evidence to provide you with.
You don't have any example of what state might have adopted this most recently, or
no? Nope.
Okay, that's all.
Mr. Jernigan,
just a couple questions. Just to quickly go back over that cost of service study that everybody loves so much. So, as I understand it, you've analyzed the cost of study that was presented
right.
to you. And presumably the company analyzed it before they put it before you. And you were here yesterday, correct?
Yes.
Did you hear Mr. Collins talk about reviewing that study as well?
I did.
And you heard him say that he has actually performed cost of service studies before and done them himself as well?
I heard that, yes.
Have you seen any testimony or anything put into the record showing that there was a significant problem with this study?
No.
Okay. And then I'm going to switch topics on you real quick, running over to the Air Force's and the rate design, where that's in. you said earlier that the numbers being so out of proportion that they wouldn't correct themselves. Is that correct?
That's true.
So if the commission doesn't take action, these numbers will continue to be where they're at, or roughly around that way. They might move around a little bit. But
well, I suppose they could change over time if, let's say, MDU had to make some significant investments to serve the Air Force. I suppose that the numbers could come down. You know, we're always just looking at what is the rate of return mm-hmm. in 2015.
You're aware that this tariff is just the cost of moving the gas to the base. It's not involving the distribution. It's actually just the moving it up.
Most of it, I think you do have some firm service in the rate 64, but yes.
Right. And so you also mentioned that you think the time to make these kinds of corrections are when prices for gas are low.
Right.
Could you explain what would happen if the gas prices were high, like say they were 2 years ago, if they tried to make this kind of adjustment, what kind of impact that might have on sure. the other customers?
Sure. Well, right now, as Ms. Aberle told us yesterday, gas prices are down a dollar since they filed this case. And so, you know, we're a dollar a decatherm. And so it's always easy to make structural changes in rate design when customers are not feeling the pinch. Now, if the residential class was on the other side and it was cost of gas was very high, it would be a lot harder to suggest structural changes at a point in time like that.
So would you agree that if the goal is to get everybody to pay their fair share of their costs, it's easier to do that when prices are low and it will have less impact on the various rates?
That's right.
And just to be clear, we're not moving to a complete cost of service here. We're following a bit of gradualism, correct?
Yes, we're following a class cost of service study that the company doesn't necessarily agree with that's beneficial to residential customers. And even using that, the residential class is not paying their fair share.
Thank you. No further questions.
Sure.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackel?
Yes, I do have a couple. Mike, we were just talking about the opportunity to make changes when the gas price happens to be lower. That dropping of that gas price by a dollar, does that not allow a little bit of flexibility and potentially in increasing the large interruptible rate? Because if there was a different maximum on that rate in the tariff, that those customers could probably pay a bit higher rate because they're saving some on gas. And is that not, you know, an opportunity there?
I guess that would be best ask of MDU.
In your opinion,
could it impact it, if that's all you're looking for? Could it change the decision to only increase the interruptible, small interruptible rates more than 6.78? I suppose it might.
And I was really asking more about the large interruptible and the 0%. Okay. There might be room for a small increase there and have that maximum go up since the price of gas is down. Is that possible?
Well, I mean, an interruptible customer, they're procuring their own gas.
And I understand that, but their total bill, what I was thinking of, their total payment is going to incorporate both, and so there might, in theory at least, be a little room for a higher negotiated rate. Okay.
That sounds reasonable.
If the commission were to choose not to have any zero increases here, it's kind of the premise that I'm starting with, based on that general philosophy that I realize you're not recommending in this case, but that nobody go without an increase. Okay.
I would just suggest that you have MDU's witness get back up and address that, because we want to make sure that there is room, and that there's, you know, gas prices change from month to month and year to year, and it's a long, setting rates is a long-term proposition, hopefully. And so I think you should talk to the people who know the business the best to make sure that if you're going to increase interruptible rates more, that there's room for that.
Okay, and I appreciate that, and I'm sure Tammy's dying to get back up and answer that. But I wanted to follow that a little bit more with you based on your the reasons, the pros and cons, and the reasons you gave for the particular rate design. When it comes to that large interruptible, you talked about, if I understood you correctly, the fact that they're bringing in a higher return than they ought to be, so to speak, was less important, I think, in this is what I heard you say, and correct me if I'm wrong, than the fact that they can make a contribution, that you can go, you know, push them to the market because everybody benefits. So I was hearing you saying that that 10.58 that's coming from large interruptible, you're not so worried that that's not down at the correct place, as long as we can all benefit from that.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
You're right. That one is of less concern because of the return that they're providing now. The reason that I didn't forcefully argue for a larger increase on small interruptible or even explore the possibilities of that is we're increasing their rates over three times the overall increase. And so
right.
To me, it just seemed like a reasonable deal.
Okay. And then on the firm general, though, that one, if I, again, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but that one is kind of so close to the correct return that it's best left alone. Is that basically your opinion, the 7.74 versus 7.34 for the 0% increase on firm general? Because there's no competitive pressure for firm general customers, correct? I mean, they're firm customers. They're not going to bail.
Well, they would probably have the wherewithal to
bail.
To bail
some
more so than residential.
Okay.
But I'm sorry, I got lost.
Well, what I was saying, is your main focus or justification that their existing or post-settlement return at 7.74 is close enough to the magic number of 7.34 that we should hold them even at 0%?
Yeah, I think that's my thinking. And I'll give you my high-level view of the whole settlement. Maybe I should have started with that. I'm trying to get the rates in a place where the next rate increase we don't have some of these large variabilities. I'm trying to get us to a place where next time everybody shares in the rate increase, because the rate of return is the rates of return amongst the classes are fairly close. And so I think now when gas prices are low, it's now is the time to make that structural change in the price.
And that would, your recommendation there is, in your mind, I'm guessing, overrides that more general policy consideration of everybody ought to share and nobody ought to get less than half or more than twice. Is that your focus at trying to correct these inequities overrides that general policy consideration?
That's why we settled where we did.
Okay. That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Mike. I forgot one question the last time we went around. How important is pipeline safety to the natural gas system?
Pretty important.
We've had some incidents with Xcel in the past that we worked through, but it's a big deal, right?
It's a big deal. Yep.
So the basic service charge that customers pay, I'm thinking that pipeline safety comes out of that charge probably. It's a cost of doing business.
So
it wouldn't come out of the gas you sell. It'd probably come out of your basic service charge to your home.
Sure.
So what I'm thinking is that whether you have a 1-inch line, a 2-inch line, a 5-inch line.
It depends, I guess, let me think about that. So are we talking about gas safety on the mains or the whole system?
The whole system.
The whole system. So could be customer charge, could also be allocated into the demand charges of each class.
But it's a cost of doing business for a home, no matter what size pipe would go to the home. The same amount of pipeline safety expense is going to be there, whether it's the 1,000 square foot or the 3,000 square foot.
Okay, sure, yes.
I'm just trying to make that point that the pipeline safety is becoming a bigger issue, and we can debate back and forth about the importance of what you might sell, but a charge of doing business is the safety that's going with all the changes out there. That might be a reason why each customer should be paying a little bit more of a basic charge, because pipeline safety is becoming a bigger deal. Does that sound reasonable?
Well, under under our proposal, the only way that the company is going to recover costs from residential is through the basic service charge. So to the extent gas safety costs go up, the customer charge will go up, and it should.
Thank you, Mike.
Commissioner Fedorchak? Okay. Commissioner Christman?
Okay.
Mr. Hsu, any follow-up?
Nothing further.
Mr. Koontz?
I do want, rather than recall Ms. Aberle, I think I can clear up one of the Mr. Diller's responses regarding the increase to large interruptibles. The opportunity, because gas prices are low, the opportunity to increase rates to large interruptible customers without impacting their total bill, that would be one consideration, but even a more important consideration would be the price of alternative fuels. So, for example, if the price of the alternative fuels went down even greater than the price of natural gas, you might you'd be exasperating the problem, would you not?
Right. Thank you for clarifying that.
That's all I have. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman, anything further? Okay. Mr. Jernigan? Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, do you have any further questions?
No, I don't. Thanks.
Okay. Commissioners, anything further for Mr. Diller? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Diller.
Thank you.
Mr. Hsu, anything further on behalf of advocacy staff?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman, does AARP have any witnesses?
No, we didn't have an expert witness. We do. There was one other matter we were hoping to offer into the evidence, and it may not be appropriate, but AARP had ask its members whether or not they wanted to sign a survey, which was on their position in this case, and they responded. We have 293 customers who did, and some of them signed, and then many of them added their own comments to it. So this is a matter of public comment, and so I guess under North Dakota law and commission practice, that's, I guess, not considered part of the evidentiary record of a rate case. So I guess I'm asking for guidance. We would like to offer these comments up for the commission to be able to see, but if it wouldn't be considered something that would be properly placed into the evidentiary record, we would ask that they be placed into the public comment section of the case file.
What is it? This is something different than those emails that were generated sent to the commissioners?
I have copies.
Go ahead, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco.
The ones that came in email would be public comment, except for the fact that they were ex parte, et cetera. If this exhibit comes in as an exhibit, it's in the record. So I guess the question is, does he want to offer this as an exhibit? And you can look further at it.
If it would be proper, we would offer it as an exhibit. Or if it would be more appropriate, we would just offer it as something that would go into the – maybe I would hand to – Executive Secretary Nishkin placed into the public comment section, but we'd like it to be in the file and available for the commissioners to see.
I guess thoughts from counsel first. Mr. Koontz?
We're going to object to this as evidence. We specifically asked for a pre-hearing conference for this very question, because we, from the last case, we got blindsided with these types of petitions at the last minute. We had no opportunity to check, you know, the source of the information that was in there. So we asked for a pre-hearing conference specifically to have the parties pre-file their testimony and offer their exhibits prior to the hearing, so this wouldn't happen again. And, of course, we're back here with the same situation despite the pre-hearing offer. So we're going to object on the basis of evidence. I suppose the commission can receive them into their file without them being part of the record, but there's a problem with these petitions, frankly. We did get copies yesterday, and we did have an opportunity to do some checking last night. And to the extent that you're going to put these into the someplace, I would offer the fact that when we did some checking, we were approximately 290 of these petitions. 55 of them don't even show up as gas customers of Montana, Dakota. That might be they're in apartment buildings where the landlord's paying the bill. It could be the case that the spouse's is on the customer bill or a significant other or whatever. But we don't have a record of 55 of these even being natural gas customers. I suspect most of them are probably electric customers, but they're not gas customers. We then did have an opportunity to kind of check, well, how do these customers relate in terms of our average customer usage of 94 decatherms? 108 of the remaining petitions that we counted had average usage below the 94 decatherms. 119 had average usage above the 94 decatherms. So I think the idea of putting these in their record, what these people, whoever drafted this, is kind of full of half-truths. I don't think these people were really informed of the effect of this rate increase. I don't know that they understood the effect of the demand charge going away. We've got people who are signing petitions who aren't even customers. So if you're going to put this into any sort of record, whether it's a public record or whatever it is, I think you've got to recognize the fact that we don't have the opportunity to cross-examine these people. We don't have the opportunity to put in evidence on these sorts of things. So that's why they definitely should not be evidence in this case. And I think they have to be really taken with a grain of salt to even be received into some sort of comment file.
Mr. Shue.
I'd agree that they shouldn't be put in the record. However, I have no objection on them being put in the public comment file.
Mr. Jernigan?
We agree with the company's objections, but have no problem with the public comment version or some lesser, something along those lines.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I don't have a position either way, but I do need the parties and everybody here to understand. If you go to the public input file, they cannot be considered by the commission. If they're not record evidence, they cannot be considered by the commission to make the decision. They can sit in the file for posterity, but they can't be considered by the commission. And so it might be a waste to put them in at all if they're not going to go in as evidence.
Okay. Commissioner Frochek, did you have
I was going to add to Alana's comment that if they go into the public comment file, the only purpose that serves is to help us leading up to the hearing. So we could read, like I did, the letters and asked a number of witnesses questions based on the letters that you provided. So I can, you know, test the legitimacy of the customer's concerns and weigh them. In this case, I have never even seen this. It would have been much more helpful to get these a week ago, even if you didn't have the total number, so that they could have helped educate my questions at the hearing. As it is, we have 290 folks out there who feel like they had spoken to us and really didn't. And that is not a situation that I am comfortable with at all.
Go ahead, Mr. Kaufman.
If there's a concern about the how these were collected or developed and who they're from, we do have Josh Aspig here, who was involved in the petition process. He, if there was a voir dire process where he could take the stand, he could explain it. But my understanding that they were, AARP members were asked whether or not they wanted to sign on, and they did. They were also given an opportunity to add a few of their own comments if they wanted. So many of these have additional comments, but they were screened to make sure that they were in the service territory, that they were AARP members that were in the MDU area. We would be satisfied if they were at least added. They were these are comments of folks that would like to have their input put on record in some fashion. We apologize if we haven't used the proper process, but we are struggling to do something that under the rules we can do that would allow greater access to the process by individual citizens. So, like I said, we would be satisfied if they would offer it into the public comment process. If the commission would like to review them beforehand, I have enough copies.
So you're asking that they be offered into the public comment?
Correct.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, I mean, she indicated what that means, and if you're satisfied with that being the avenue, I would allow them to be submitted into the public comment. They wouldn't be considered an exhibit.
As I understand, and it's our understanding that they would not be something that could be cited in a decision, per se, but that they would be part of the public record.
Yeah. I'm satisfied with that. I guess, Mr.
Can we take a short break? I'd like to talk with Alana before we make a decision on this.
All right, that's fine. We'll break for 10 minutes, come back on the record.
Be fine for me.
All right, that's fine.
Basic math, right?
Right.
Okay. All right, we're back on the record. We're addressing the issue of the AARP survey, I guess. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, did you have anything additional you'd like to add at this point?
No, I guess I just want to be sure everyone understands that commissioners can't consider anything to make a decision that's outside the record evidence.
Okay.
And Commissioner Fedorchuk and I were talking, so I think she may have a statement.
Commissioner Fedorchuk?
Well, it's mostly to reiterate what my concerns were before. This matter of public input is a big deal, and it needs to be done in a way that actually allows us to consider it. And I feel like there was enough discussion ahead of time, just with the letters, that the AARP knew the process and should have gotten us these letters, these petitions, ahead of time to the point where we can consider them. As it stands now, either they don't get entered into the record, which they won't. They don't get entered into the public input file because they're kind of meaningless there. And then we get blamed for not taking public comment. Or we take the public comment and it doesn't affect it anything. So I would have looked at them if you had provided them ahead of time. And I really hope, I like having you guys involved. I hope you do it in a way that it can be constructive in the future.
Go ahead, Mr. Kaufman.
Well,
go ahead, Commissioner Crispin, I'm sorry.
Just to add to that, one of the objections, if I remember everything accurately, was that in looking at least a sampling of these petitioners that were in fact MDU gas customers, it sounded like a significant number. If I recall right, it was even over half are higher than average volume users that, according to the petition, are protesting the change but actually personally benefit from the change. And so in the objection, when it seems like the questions are kind of full of half-truths, it seems like that would have some merit potentially. And what I find most disheartening about this is, out of whatever, I forget the number of total petitioners there are here, there potentially are some of those people who, had they not gotten involved in this process and then had their concerns held through the pretrial conference and waited until the last minute like this, when we can't really use them according to the evidentiary rules, they might have searched out other avenues to get their opinions heard that would have been useful to us, and so they actually had their voices muffled, and so I find that disappointing.
Commissioner Kolk?
We had public input sessions in these. People forget about the rate case. It was a huge process. There was public input sessions that were held on two different days in I don't know, 8 different locations. So I think the public clearly had enough chance to say what they wanted in those public input sessions. You hired an attorney. They're supposed to know what they're doing to do this stuff. So I think the public's had their chance to say it. So I just want to reinforce it. Not only does a rate case have the hearing, but 2 separate public input sessions throughout numerous communities that MDU is at with our staff. So there's been a lot of chances for folks to say their piece.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman, go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate the commissioner's comments, and we certainly did not intend to blindside anyone or to do it something that was not according to the local custom here. You know, different states have a variety of different methods, and we would certainly like to work with the North Dakota Commission to find ways to be more productive. It's the organization's goal to try to expand the opportunity for public comment and to do that in the proper way and under the rules. It was our understanding that today was sort of a cutoff. The hearing was a cutoff for public comment. But we would like to have those discussions about other ways that customers, the citizens, can get more involved. On the specific issue of the high customer charge, it is a matter that the organization has received tremendous input from its members that this is a priority issue. And surprisingly, even when there have been surveys and further exploration of why this is such a matter, I mean, it was a surprise to me that the comments about opposing fixed charges often come from customers even after they are told that they use more than the average, that the concern is more about being able to control your bill than even a concern that the usage was less than the average. So that was kind of a surprise to me. But we believe it is evidence of a strong sentiment that a segment of the public feels strongly about it. And it has been, expert testimony here at this hearing that focused quite a bit on what the public thinks and the public's beliefs. So we do believe it's relevant. However, we won't begrudge whatever you say and apologize if we have not followed the proper procedures. But look forward to doing it more properly in the future.
Okay. I'm going to sustain the objection of Montana, Dakota, and advocacy staff with respect to admitting these surveys as an exhibit. The hearing it's been noticed for quite some time. AARP has been a party for some time. We did have the pre-hearing conference that, to address these issues and get these things out. And there was we went over some of that with respect to the emails from the AARP. So I think there was sufficient notice that if there was something like this, that we did need to have as an exhibit earlier. And as Mr. Kuntz indicated, there are serious foundational and, evidentiary issues with this. He wouldn't have really the opportunity to cross-examine on these. So for those reasons, I will sustain the objection, and these will not be marked as an exhibit and entered into the record. So, anything further, I guess, on behalf of AARP at this time, Mr. Kaufman?
No, that's fine. That's all we would have.
Okay. Then FEA, Mr. Jernigan, we went out of order, before we've got your testimony. Is there anything else on behalf of FEA?
No, the FEA is complete. Thank you. We appreciate you taking the time, and I'm sorry we changed our schedule around a little bit. Felt that it might be more important to keep Mr. Collins around just to make sure everybody got full information. And I apologize for the.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, is there any rebuttal? Are you intending to recall any witnesses?
No, Your Honor, and not unless the commission has some reason that they want us to address something that hasn't been addressed already. I think I cleared up the one issue that we had with Mr. Diller on that.
Okay.
Large interruptible customer.
Sure. I guess there was some discussion of potentially recalling Ms. Aberle, but as you indicate, Commissioner Kalk, did that clear that issue up? Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacker, did you have anything before we move on to closings?
I actually do have one request.
Okay.
Commissioner Fedorchik and I also discussed outside. I was thinking about asking Mike for this, but I'm just going to ask staff, and I think they'll probably have to work with the other parties to produce it. But if staff could produce that PSC4, the chart, but with a 0% for the Air Force as opposed to a reduction. And the reason I probably have to work with the company because you have to decide where that other money's going. But we'd like to see those numbers. The commission would like to see those numbers, or at least one commissioner, and see how that chart flows out if the Air Force did not get a reduction. So that would be a late filed. That could be your 4A.
Mr. Shue, is that something that you can provide as a late-filed exhibit?
Yes, Your Honor. We should be able to provide that.
And I guess we can identify that as Exhibit 4A, the late-filed. Anything further, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No, thank you.
Okay. Are we prepared to move on to closing statements, Mr. Koons?
We are, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you. I want to first thank the commission for your attention and patience in this case, and I want to the cooperation of the other parties, advocacy staff, and although we've disagreed with AARP, they were good to work with in this case and FEA as well. So we appreciate that. Rate cases aren't easy. For anybody, they take a lot of resources. I don't want to disappoint Mr. Shook, but I don't know that this will be our last. I mean, we're going to continue to have to make some significant investments out there. There's new rules on integrity that are coming down, so we're probably going to be back in a not too short future. But I would also point out that that's a product of our growth. Just as our government is having to build roads and fire halls and schools and hire teachers and inspectors and employees, we're having to do the same thing, and there's costs associated with that. The investment associated with the new development is not the same investment per customer as a system that's been depreciated over the last 20 and 30 years. So there's costs associated with doing that. But that, I think, is a whole lot better than where we were 20 years ago when every school district in the state was seeing declines in the population and our small towns were drying up. That, to me, that was a lot more depressing situation than having a 3% and 2% and 3% and 4% rate increases. And sometimes our property taxes go up because we have to fund schools and roads and fire halls. But I think that's, again, a good situation. That a whole lot better than the alternative. So, I really do appreciate your patience here. The revenue requirement issue, there certainly doesn't seem to be any disagreement amongst the parties here. Hopefully the commission will accept the settlement on that issue. We're down to a pretty modest increase of about 2%. I think customers can understand that you just can't go along forever without any increase. They're seeing increases in all their cable bill and their other services bill. They're paying similar type increases as well. So that gets into then the two issues that remain are the allocation among the classes. No one put in a separate class cost of service study. Mr. Diller made some suggested adjustments that were the company accepted for purposes of the settlement and allocating it, and with that adjustment and the way that the company is and the staff has proposed allocating the increase across the customer classes, for the most part, with the exception of the airbase, gets the classes pretty close to their cost of service. I mean, I think that's what Mr. Diller's objective was, and so that we're not continually having the catch up. Maybe now we're pretty close, so we won't have to see disparate increases certainly as much in the future. I know that there has been, a commission, I would say a practice. I wouldn't go so far as saying it was a policy because I don't believe it's been followed in every single rate case. I think there have been exceptions where the increase wasn't applied to certain classes, or at least not certainly necessarily a half, or every class got a cost. But as Mr. Diller pointed out, if you use that, what I'll call the smoothing effect forever, you never get there. you increase the increment gets smaller, but you never get there. We do have an opportunity, I think, here with a relatively small increase of a couple percent at a time when natural gas prices have come down to get us a lot closer. So we've got the framework. So if we do have to come back in the next couple, 3 years, hopefully these get a little simpler. I think you asked Mr. Diller the question about, you know, the cooperation with the company and so forth. And I think part of that's a function that we were just in here a couple years ago. Gas cases, frankly, are easier than electric cases. I think the staff would agree with that. And the fact that you just looked at us a year or so ago, familiar with our numbers and stuff, you know, it makes it, you know, though you don't like having to come in that often, that it does make it a little bit easier to get through. So hopefully if we get this rate design thing straightened out, in this case, that's not going to be as much of an issue in future cases in the event that we do have to come back. And then so we get then to the monthly fixed charge, which was really the, you know, the big elephant in the room, if you will, or the big objection by AARP. It's a philosophical thing for the AARP. It's a national philosophical thing. Frankly, I don't think that local people would be making the issue here if this weren't the national a drumbeat from the AARP. When you look at the impact in this particular case of going from one to the other, getting rid of the demand charge to a $2 increase in the fixed charge, frankly, doesn't seem to justify some of the things that, you know, you've seen in the paper and so forth. So this is a policy position. We saw it when we went to 10 to 15. We're seeing when we go to 15 to 20 or 18 to 20 or whatever it is, they're going to oppose it. And that's fine. That's their right to do that, and they've done that here. But they're not challenging the fact that these really are the costs they're providing. No one's arguing that these aren't fixed costs associating with the customers. The argument is, well, it discourages conservation. Well, if that were really their concern, first of all, you got 71% of the bill is directly related to usage and the cost of commodities. So you can affect 71% of your bill by conservation, but if you think about it, it's also inconsistent with their policy of not wanting the residential customer to pick up the full amount of the increase to get to a rate of return. Doing that, pushing that cost off onto other customer classes, frankly, discourages conservation. So you're kind of a little bit inconsistent here, I think, from the AARP, and the only real justification that they have for not going to the fix versus the demand charge. I think there's, without getting to this fixed charge the way we've proposed, you've got a cross-subsidy amongst households. And that the larger users are subsidizing the smaller users. There's not much question about that. And that's got nothing to do with whether you're a senior or not. As someone who falls into the senior category, I'd like somebody to subsidize my bill too, but that doesn't necessarily mean I can't afford to pay my bill less than a family of five or six that's, you know, probably in a tougher economic situation than a lot of seniors are. So I don't think there's any direct correlation between the fact that you're a senior and your ability to pay your bill. Certainly, there are some seniors that are in that situation, but it's not across the board, and not all seniors are below average users. So I don't think it's fair to categorize all seniors and dump them into a particular position and say that they're going to be disadvantaged by going to the fixed cost. On this whole cross subsidy thing, if you think about it, your gas company, and you've got two houses side by side on the same street, one who's using a lot of gas and one who's using not hardly any, other than the cost of gas, ask yourself, what do I save from serving that one customer versus the other? And as a practical matter, it's virtually nothing. I mean, other than the cost of gas and the transportation charges, the cost of serving those two customers is virtually the same. So I think the fixed, it's time to get there, I guess, is really kind of the point. Now's the time. Now's the time to do it. Bite the bullet. Get the rates in place. I think, as you saw, as Mr. Diller pointed out with the NSP, I don't think there's going to be really much impact if we do a decent job of explaining that particular distribution charge is going to be gone. It's going to simplify the bill. It's going to be a lot easier to explain in the future, you know, in terms of rate increases and so forth, for people to understand what the impact is going to be. So, again, I appreciate your patience, and we urge the commission to accept the settlement in its full. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu.
Just briefly, Your Honor. I know you heard from Mr. Shook and you heard from Mr. Diller, and advocacy staff does strongly believe in this settlement. We believe is fair and reasonable to both the customers as well as the company. We do recognize that there's various ways to do the class cost of service, but as Mr. Diller laid out, we do believe this is the best approach going forward. Furthermore, with a standard fixed variable rate, this is something we're familiar with. We've had in the past, we've had a positive experience with it. It's very simple, and also it prevents subsidization within one class, which could be argued possibly as discriminatory within the class. With 71% of their bill, as council has stated, coming from fuel charges as it is, there's still plenty of incentive to conserve energy, and there's still plenty of opportunity and flexibility in order to reduce their bills. And with taking all this into consideration and all the other testimony that you've heard today, we just request that you approve this settlement agreement in its entirety.
Mr. Kaufman?
Yes. Thank you. First of all, I wanted to thank the commission for allowing us to intervene in this case. And, you know, although we may have stumbled and not followed all the procedures correctly, we'll hopefully figure that out better next time. I have to say that I'm really impressed with how engaged each of you have been. I have the opportunity to appear before a lot of commissions, and most commissioners are not as thorough and focused on the evidence, and so I'm really, and I'm not just saying that to butter you up, I think that I really am impressed with how, not only how friendly this forum is, but also how thorough and thoughtful it is. And although we have some, you know, serious disagreements on a couple matters of policy here, I think it's noteworthy that 90% of the issues here have been resolved without any contention, and that the ones that we did have, we were able to, in a fairly civil way, work out, and everyone has had their say, and we thank you for that. The issues with regard to rate design, again, I won't say much more about the class allocations, although I would just ask that you take a look again at the residential class and see if you couldn't moderate that further. And, you know, I guess AARP was accused of being contradictory about the cost of service, and I guess I could throw that back as far as utility. We feel that maybe the cost of service study is being relied on a little too heavily with the allocation of customer classes, but not taken a serious enough look at it with regard to the changes within the residential class. So I know it's a balancing act, and I don't envy your decision and what you have to do to take it all into account. But on the fixed basic service charge, we feel that that the record in this case, both with the MDU's witness and with the staff witness, Mr. Diller, we think that there's evidence there that supports our contention that the proper way to set the rates for residential customers is not entirely based on the incidence of customers, and that there are other factors that should be taken into account based on the evidence and the actual cost of service study in this case. And we also feel that there are important policy reasons to not completely eliminate the volumetric portion of the delivery rate. And not necessarily just because a particular type of demographic might be a lower user than a higher user. Based on what we have seen of public sentiment, there's a strong sentiment that people want to be able to control their bill as much as possible and get the highest economic value from their efforts to control their bill. And just to help you understand what perspective we're coming from, we think that, you know, there have been, you know, decades, if not 100 years, of putting a variable a usage-based component in the delivery rate. And in a matter of 2 years, if the settlement is approved on this point, it will have gone from $9 to more than twice that, $19.60, the fixed charge. And we are asking that you take a look at that. We believe that our position is not the extreme one here. We don't have any opposition to a fixed charge. We believe that the current one may be a little too high, but we're willing to accept that. We felt that what the result that came out of the last rate case was a good and balanced decision, and we would ask that you stick with that. The $14 service charge is high enough, and it asks that in your final decision that you at least include some fixed portion, which we think is appropriate because there are some costs that are customer-only based, but that you also balance that with some volumetric portion and leave some usage component in the delivery rate. We think that, again, also the high fixed cost is, it is discriminatory to an extent in the fact that high users and low users have to pay the same amount regardless of their usage. I think that covers our main concerns with that issue. And again, thank you for allowing us to be here.
Mr. Jernigan.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioners, for having us here today. Kind of want to start out with just trying to clear up a little bit of the confusion I caused when I mentioned that I'm not just the Air Force, I'm the federal executive agencies. So when I say I'm the federal executive agencies, I am here for the federal executive branch and any customer who takes service from MDU under that branch. And generally, that actually puts me in a good position when I'm sitting in front of you talking about rate design, because most of my clients fall within more than one category. And so as a policy decision that I have to make in order to properly represent my clients, I have to argue we pay our fair share. We pay cost of service. I don't want my smaller clients to be paying more, and I don't want my larger clients to be paying more. So when we came into this case, we looked at what our cost of service was for the rate design, and we saw that the same thing that you see in PSC 4. There is a large disparity between what the Air Force is paying under their rates as compared to the other rate classes. And we understand that moving entirely could cause rate shock, and we don't want to hurt anybody. We don't want to hurt our other portions of ourselves as well. So we were asking for a gradualism when we moved in here. And when we looked at the settlement and we discussed things with the parties, this settlement is a compromise of our position. If you look at what we originally filed and where we were at, we're talking about over $400,000 just under the current system. And when you look at that spread amongst the classes, we heard today that might help the residential individual bill somewhere between 2 and 12 cents. Well, for the base, that's our O&M money. That's our operation and maintenance. That's money that goes to troops to train, to equip, and to organize, and to get our mission done. And while 12 cents may be significant to some folks, that $400,000 really goes to a big portion of our budget. And it's a budget that's shrinking, as I'm sure you're aware as you look at the papers today. Our military forces are having to constrain their budgets. Sequestration's still around. We're still getting tighter. And that money that we are currently overpaying could be put to a different use to make sure that we are properly helping these men and women as they go out and protect our nation. And we're not asking that we get a reduction in our rates. We're not asking that we be paying less than what we owe. These are costs that we incur on that system, and we want to pay those. We want to pay what's proper. And we don't want to overburden anybody on this system. Right now, the cost of fuel are low. The impact of moving us to that cost of service is much lower than you would have had a couple of years ago. And I can't predict the rates where they'll go in the future, but we have the opportunity to have the minimal impact and get us a little bit closer so that the folks are paying what they deserve, what they, the cost that they're incurring, and get the reasonable rates in return that the utility requires. And that's what we ask when we say, please adopt what's in the settlement. Going any other direction that just allows this disparity to continue on and burdens the Air Force and their mission in order to help 2 or 12 cents out there. And while I understand that that can be significant for many people, we just wish to consider the impact that that has on us as well. And thank you.
Thank you. Just before we end with the commissioner's closing comments, are there any other issues that should be addressed on the record, Mr. Kuntz?
No, I believe we have one or two late file exhibits that we'll be submitting within the next few days. But other than that, no.
Okay. Mr. Shue?
Same with us. We have one late file exhibit, 4A, I believe. 4A.
Yep. Mr. Kaufman?
Nothing
further. Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
No, sir. Thank you.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, is there anything else?
Will the parties be filing proposed decisions?
Mr. Kuntz?
I hope so.
I assumed that we were going to file proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law. We typically, the hearing officer gives us a deadline to do that off the record, so I assume that's how we were going to handle it again.
Okay.
Maybe we should go ahead and put those deadlines on the record this time around because we have more parties than normal.
Sure. I'm not aware. Are there any time constraints with respect to this that they need to be filed sooner? Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything you're aware
of? There's nothing in statute, but, you know, I don't know about the company's position. They've waived the implementation date that would have otherwise taken effect.
Sure. Mr. Kuntz, do you have a time frame in mind?
Probably 2 or 3 weeks from this Friday would be sufficient for us to get proposed findings together.
What is
even quicker than that, considering we just did this a couple years ago, so we do have a somewhat of a template that we'd be using.
So we're September 1 today. What I don't know what Friday is.
Either the 18th or the 25th, I think I can get something together.
Well, you want to put the 25th out there to be safe?
That would be safe.
Okay.
Fine.
Mr. Shue, is that going to work for advocacy staff?
Be agreeable to that.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
I think that would be sufficient. The record of this proceeding is just the video record, and that would be will that be available to rewatch?
That would be available through. Oh, go ahead, Ms. Jeff.
I don't think it's a video. I think it's an audio.
Audio.
And yes, it'll be available online when it's docketed, or we can provide you a copy of it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan, that's sufficient. Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Anything else, Ms. Jeff Kotsako? Is that?
No.
Okay. All right. We'll move on to closing comments from the commissioners. Commissioner Kalk.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's always dangerous to let us all talk last, right? I thought this was a pretty good hearing. It was brought out some issues that I hadn't seen before that we'll use going forward. I really do think when the interveners come out, it makes for a better hearing. We'll go back to where I started, that AARP, if you're worried about cost to your consumers, get engaged at the Clean Power Plant. The costs are phenomenal. And for the federal facilities, I don't know how you can engage that because you're one of the DOD installations that's it's tough. It's a lot tougher for you. But that's probably the biggest thing that we're going to be struggling with, like speaking for myself, of how that's going to be played out in North Dakota. Getting back to this case, we've got a commission meeting tomorrow, so I'm sure we'll schedule a work session immediately. It won't take long, I think, for the three of us to see where we're at on this. But, you know, the choices here are pretty simple. We either accept or reject the settlement. That's one thing, with everybody kind of coming in there saying they like the settlement, if there's something that we don't like in the settlement, it's hard to do anything with it because there isn't much of a record around it. So that'll be the first question that I guess I'll ask my colleagues about. As far as my initial thoughts, never rule from the bench, I get that. But
the settlement agreements, you were all able to move the ball quite a bit from the $4-plus million down to the $2-something million, so I think that's a significant move. But I think going forward, we will be back in here again. But I really like the company and our own staff to these multi-year solutions that can give you the certainty that you're looking for, that can take the customers' preferences in their needs. I think that's what we kind of need to get to with all of our investor owns, because I think we are in a period now where there's just so much uncertainty with the Clean Power Plan and other things that we're not going to be able to have these rate cases be 5, 6, 10 years apart. And we shouldn't. We should probably even consider, like we do for some of these transmission tariffs, that we true them up every year. If there's a way that we can get somewhere to rate cases where we do something like that, I'd be all for that. We're having a lot of discussion with other commissions around the country about ways to functionally change the whole way of rate making to get to where you get what you need to do your business, the customers are protected, but we don't have these, you know, procedural public input sessions and hearings that go on and on. We really can get to what it is you need to keep the customers out there, because there are getting to be more choices for everything. So off of my rampage, but I think good hearing. I think this will, you get your late filed exhibits in. I don't think it'll take long for the decision to come out of this one. So thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
I'll echo my colleagues' appreciation to all the parties involved. This whole effort is really part science and a lot of art. And I think that becomes more and more clear the more you dig into it, actually looks more artistic. For us, getting to the best result requires input from a lot of different parties. And so I especially want to thank the interveners. It's a time commitment. It's a financial commitment to intervene. But your perspectives from customers are really invaluable for us in weighing this. We can't begin to think of all the different ways these our decisions would impact customers. And so hearing from you to help explain that is really, really important and helpful. The average person would really struggle to get involved in a process like this. We try to keep it easy. We try to make it accessible. But the reality is it's not a legislative process. It's not a political process. This is a legal process. And it's not the easiest thing for citizens to get involved in. So thanks again, interveners, for bringing that perspective to the table. In terms of this case, there's a lot of issues here. You settled a lot of them, the big issues. A few still remain and really we're at the crux of the discussion the last 2 days. The good news is we've got a lot of great information on the record to make a decision, and I'm pretty comfortable with that and comfortable that we'll come up with a good decision in fairly short order. So thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman?
Well, Commissioner Kalk has stole my thunder on the Clean Power Plan, and then the real concern about higher rates coming down the road. But I'll just echo the thanks to the company and everyone involved. I don't come in here with any more of a stake in what the decision is on a case like this than anyone else. We all want the lowest possible rates, but we want a company that's strong enough to make sure that our service is good. And so... I'm not looking for people to provide information to oppose a rate case or people to provide information to support one. I'm looking for people to provide information so we can make the best possible decision, whichever that is. And in this case, as complicated as these are, I think that between the company and our staff and interveners, we've managed to get a lot of good information to help us understand all the issues involved and reach a good conclusion. There are a few things here I feel very strongly about, a few things where I'm more flexible, but I think generally things are clear enough that when the last filings are made, from my own perspective, I don't see that this will take a long time to reach a conclusion, and I look forward to finishing up the process and through the rest of the way here.
Thank you, and that will conclude the public hearing on this matter.
Thank you, Your Honor.